Hello, and welcome to Marketing in the Raw. That is the podcast, and I am the host, Adam Helway from Secret Sushi. It is my goal to expand how you define the practice of marketing and your vision of where it's headed, especially in a digitally connected world. Hey, I have one request from you. One. If you like this podcast, if you like this episode, could you please go subscribe? Go subscribe, and I promise you there are lots of other great episodes as well, and we have some more coming in the future, but it would be incredible if you would join us beyond this episode as I continue to produce more podcast episodes here in this year and beyond, and you can be a part of that journey with me. All right, now that that's out of the way, today I get to talk with the brilliant Carla Johnson. Carla is a storyteller, speaker, prolific author, and an expert in customer experience storytelling and content strategy, to name a few things. She gives us a taste of her wonderful new book called Rethink Innovation: How the World's Most Prolific Innovators Come Up with the Great Ideas That Turn into Extraordinary Outcomes. In this episode, she shares the key for unlocking innovation and bringing brilliant ideas to life. We discuss creativity's impact on revenue, and how to build a business culture that fosters innovation to stand out from competitors. Here's Carla Johnson. Carla Johnson, I am so happy to be talking to you. I have been an appreciator of your work from the past. You've written quite a few books, and one of my favorite is the book Experiences, The Seventh Era of Marketing. That's the correct title, right?
That's right, yes.
And so I'm happy to talk with you about something that's near and dear to my heart. As somebody who actually started in the creative field, you are helping folks unlock innovation and creativity these days. And I want to talk with you a little bit about it. But as somebody who has written books and talked about topics like customer experience and storytelling and content strategy, now talking about this innovation and creativity, like, how did we get here? What's the thread that ties this all together and has inspired you to go down this road of focus at the moment?
You know, that's, Adam, that question right there is one of the reasons I couldn't wait to talk to you on your podcast today, because you are, I listened to some of your episodes, because you have great people on here. And of course, our friend, Robert Rose. And it was interesting, because this path down this road of creativity and innovation really started with its roots in the Experiences book that Robert and I wrote. And it was so well received. And people said, I love knowing how to do this now. And I love having a process. And I understand how it all fits together. But one question I consistently heard was, how do I actually come up with the more creative ideas so that all of this works to the potential that it could? And for me, I mean, seriously, I remember being in second grade and sitting in school and the, you know, art class or some class. I mean, I went to a one room country school. It wasn't like I'm in a room of 50 people. There's eight of us. And the ideas started coming. And I had all of these ideas. And I remember the teacher like telling me, like, stop, that's enough. And I couldn't figure out why the people around me weren't the same way. And I just kind of assumed everybody was that way. And it wasn't until I grew up and, you know, went through college, started working, and nicely, one of the things that really affected my input or my outlook on creativity and innovation and how it works is that my first marketing job was for architects. And architects are masters at understanding what's the experience you want to create. Now, how do we reverse engineer into that? That worked really well and was so helpful as Robert and I wrote Experiences. And then looking at, okay, well, if what you want to create is a very unique idea, what I asked people around the world is, you know, this great idea that you've had, how'd you get the, like, where did it come from? How'd you get the inspiration? And they said, I don't know, it just came to me. And so I realized, okay, that doesn't work. So I would ask them, well, what happened right before that? And they could tell me that. And then I'd say, what happened before that? And they could tell me that. Mm. And so we could reverse engineer it. And then realizing, I mean, even the people I interviewed, they would see, oh my gosh, I follow this pattern, this process all the time. I just don't realize it. And so understanding that the ability to come up with great ideas, particularly under a deadline, is something that mattered so much, particularly for marketers, because you talk about people who are under deadlines. Now, this doesn't mean an idea for creative, as people often think of marketers, but it's a creative idea, an innovative idea, something that I talk about being, it's great, it's new, it's reliable, meaning you can make money off it, you know, have an impact to the bottom line, but you're also able to come up with these level of high quality ideas consistently. And so it's the big revelation for me was that it's actually a really simple process. And the most innovative people, you know, marketers, designers, you know, people in every industry, they all follow the same process, whether they realize it or not.
Yeah, I was going to say when you that ending point where whether they realize it or not, that the folks like you were sort of self-identifying as you were younger, and other folks that we might feel as being creative and innovative, they are doing something that just sort of innately is within them. But as you were saying, because you've gone down that path and reverse engineered it and done the work, you can see that it is something that people can duplicate it in a lot of ways. And you know, for me, as somebody who's been in the creative field, started off in the creative field, especially, and it's still a big part of me, I continue to be fascinated by the cool and creative things that people can do both in business and outside of business. But it seems that for every one innovator or artist that's out there, there seems to be 10,000 people that say that they don't have the capacity to be creative or innovative. And my question was going to be, why is that? But would you say it's simply because folks don't understand that there really is a path that they can sort of go through, a process that they can go through? Why are there those 10,000 folks that just simply say, that's just not me?
The 10,000 folks who say, it's just not me, have forgotten that that's how they naturally show up in the world. And there's some interesting research that came out years ago, I'm going to say in the 60s, from a gentleman named George Land. And he was a systems engineer who became really interested in creativity and where ideas come from and things along that line that we're talking about today. And somebody from NASA, one of the directors, reached out to George when he started his consultancy and said, we know that we have really creative engineers. We just don't know who they are. Can you help us identify them so we can bring more of that creativity out and nurture that within our environment? So George and his team worked to come up with an assessment that helped identify the most creative engineers and helped NASA with the problem they wanted to solve. And when that assignment was done, George started to think, okay, like you look at kids. I mean, we're talking about your four-year-old and my teenagers, you know, before we started, they have a jillion ideas. I mean, like me when I was in second grade. And he said, what happens from the time they're like that, four, until they're 40 and they're a NASA engineer? And he made adjustments to that assessment and he gave it to a group of five-year-olds. And interestingly, they scored 98% of these five-year-olds scored at the genius level of creativity. Mm. And then he said, well, you know, again, I need to figure out what happens between 4 and 40 or 5 and 50. And so he gave that assessment to the same group when they were 10, and then again when they were 15. And he saw it go from like 98% when they were 5 years old, to 30% when they were 10 years old, to 12% when they were 15 years old. And then if the average age of all of the adults, I mean, he surveyed over a million adults, the average age was about 31, and they were at 2%. And wow. So what happens is that we get this taught out of us, where, you know, a lot of creativity and innovation as adults is about trying things and failing and just, you know, learning and doing and experimenting and testing and pretending and trying. That's not allowed in school. It's not allowed in college. It's not allowed on SAT tests and ACT tests and all of these tests that we have to monitor kids' behavior and development as they grow through school. And if they go to college and, you know, depending on what kind of college, you know, that could be your death sentence, is to start thinking for yourself and having ideas. And then we get into the real world and people are saying, I can't believe it. You can't come up with a creative idea to save your life. You're not innovative. This is, you know, I just can't get my team to do anything. Well, it's because for a majority of their life, they've been rewarded out of creativity. And it's not something that you can't recover. You know, like riding a bike, you know, after a while, when you haven't done it for a long time, you can get on, you'll be rusty, you'll be stiff, not everything's going to come back to you right away. But you can relearn this as a process at any age. And the beauty of it is when I watch people re-remember this, you know, what it's like to come up with a lot of ideas and really have your mind on fire, it is an incredible vision of joy that they have about themselves and the potential that they see that they can put into their work that they didn't think about in other ways. And it doesn't mean creative as in here's the look and feel and anything. It's creative and innovative about how they solve problems. And that's really the biggest thing that business needs now more than anything is people who look at how they can solve problems from different perspectives.
Well, I love that. I want to dive into some of those things that you were talking about, and the first one being about how this sort of has an impact on business. We were talking a little bit about ahead of the podcast that some time ago, I went and taught a session on creativity in business, specifically creativity's impact on business. And in my lesson, I was talking about a McKinsey report that came out a while back ago. And funny enough, as I was looking at this, because I wanted to ask your opinion on it, I was doing a little research to see if there was an update on this. And the second search result about this report was you covering it some years ago for very similar reasons. And so the report, if I can remember everything correctly, is that McKinsey, a management consulting firm, they released a report that was talking about how they were trying to show that creativity in business actually turns into value and what value that is and so on. And they have something called the Award Creativity Score, the ACS score, and it's based on looking at companies that were winning awards in the Cannes Lions Advertising and Marketing Excellence category. And they found that the top performers, they were outperforming wildly in three different areas: in organic revenue growth, total return on shareholder value, and net economic value. And so they were studying these different elements to, just like you, sort of reverse engineering it and saying, so what is it that was creating this? And because in the end, what they realized is, okay, great, there's speed and adaptation and problem solving. These are all components that help breed innovation. If you have those things, you have innovation. And a couple of those, there were four elements that they believe that were being practiced by the most creative and innovative companies. And I'm only going to bring two of them up right now and hear what you think is. One is that creativity, because this is sort of what you're talking about here, because having a person and an individual learn to be creative is different than an organization. But creativity is a major part of company culture. That's what they found was one part. And the second, number two, that I want to share is that they set up a framework for deciding and acting faster. And that includes making it okay for mistakes to happen, making it okay to think about things that may not be common, common practice and stuff within the company. So what are your, there's proof in here that creativity begets innovation, which begets business growth. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, and I remember when I found this research and I was fascinated by it, because a lot of people perceive that innovation has a bottom line impact on revenue, but creativity is a really nice, fluffy, pretty nice to have. And when times get tough, the last word you want to bring up is let's be creative, because people assume it's going to be expensive, time consuming, ridiculous, and you know, all of these fluffy things that we have this stereotype about creativity. But I want to be very clear that An organization cannot be innovative unless they recognize, appreciate, and nurture creativity. And you have to be able to set that standard. And organizations, and you said the right word, like the cultural aspect of it, is that you have to look at how do we really democratize these things that we're wanting to be known for. You can't just tap a group of, you know, 10 people, you're the creative people, you're the innovative people, and everybody else move aside, you know, because they're the ones who get things done, because that's not how it works. Because it doesn't matter if you raise the output of those creative and innovative teams by 50%, if you have a culture that's anti creativity or innovation, they will put up roadblocks either intentionally or not intentionally for anything you try to do or change. And then all of this effort is for naught. And then that's when you get people who say creativity doesn't work. Like, look, we put all this money into it, and we've gotten squat out of it. Same for innovation, you know, and they just dismantle these isolated innovation or creative teams, you know, design thinking teams, or however you want to label them. And I mean, I've already seen that tremendously in organizations during the pandemic, as the pressure gets put on performance, they just dismantle them. And it's because there's not a culture that practices it. It's not hardwired into it. And to be able to have a culture that is truly appreciative and practices creativity and innovation, you have to understand the micro consistencies that you need to practice. So it's not about, you know, the big, bold, disruptive things, but what can you do in little steps every single day to move further in that direction? It's no different than an athlete who's trying to get better at their form, you know, a runner, a cook who wants to move into being, you know, a line cook who wants to be a chef. You know, you have to look at the consistency of small actions. That's what adds up to the big practices. And then once you have that, you have an appreciation for it, and you are creating opportunities for people to be proactive about creativity and innovation. Now, the one thing that happens is that all of a sudden, their practices aren't these huge mountains, they're these little molehills. And so if something doesn't go right, it's much less risk to an organization. And so they see, you know, I can try and push my own comfort zone and fail, and the world doesn't come shattering down around me. And you want that in an organization. You want them to continue to try and push the envelope, you know, at smaller and smaller increments, because then when you're able to do that, you start to move much faster. And you were talking about the other aspect of this ACS research is that it said that they're able to translate their insights into action much faster. And the most innovative companies, I think it was about 3/4 of them, said that their decision-making was much faster than the groups who weren't as high-performing in tying their creativity to their bottom-line revenue.
Well, because when you're creative, right? I mean, think of it from the perspective of an artist. Let's just say a graphic designer. Most folks don't know that, like, graphic design, or pretty much any creative field, you can go on and on and on indefinitely on ideas. You can continue to do thumbnails and try things out. In a lot of ways, you know, having something in your head to then doing a proof of concept, a paper prototype, whatever it is that you want to do, a pilot program, you need to do those things sometimes, but you need to select which one. You got to prioritize which one it is that you do, that you pursue. And so I would say that the thing that stood out to me here about acting faster and deciding faster is deciding which path to start taking, you know, because there could be 50 different paths that could feel equally, have equal merit, but you've got to decide one and you've got to take action. And at least in my experience, taking action and creative things may mean that, yeah, if had I gone through option B, things could have been better, but option, you know, C is awesome still. And I took action on it and I walked down that path and made it happen. So I would imagine that those individuals who are taking action faster, that's such an art to be able to know when to say, okay, we've done enough iterating on this. It's very similar to, I don't know if you've ever had the experience where somebody's doing something creatively And you've got those folks that, I'm sorry, it is the worst. It's the worst type of client to have. It's the worst type of leadership to have, which is, I don't know what I don't want. I mean, I don't know what I want until you show me enough options to tell you all the things I don't want. And that starts to take things and balloon it into something tremendous and huge. And I would imagine, obviously, it ends up slowing a lot of things down, not to mention kill the creativity of the folks that are trying to help drive that process.
Totally. And there's a macro and a micro, macro and micro solutions to that exact thing. And the macro one, and this is why marketers are totally, totally the ones positioned at the helm of innovation in an organization, is because the companies that are led by purpose are more innovative because they understand the bigger problem that they're trying to solve. And when you always have that North Star, then you have, I'm not saying you won't have any of it, but you have significantly left of the, I don't know what's innovative, but I'll know it when I see it kind of response. And so when everybody is pointing toward that North Star, one, you have an immediate level of alignment that organizations that aren't driven by purpose don't have. So that helps from the big picture. Now, from more of a micro scale, I tell people one of the worst things about innovation and pitching the new ideas is that people don't know how to ask for feedback. And the people they're pitching to, I call them the catchers, they don't know how to give it. And what happens is the people pitching the idea are afraid to ask because they may say something, they might not want to hear the feedback. They don't know how to ask for it. That doesn't, they feel stupid. Like, oh, I should probably know what what they're going to ask. I should know everything going into this.
Yeah.
A pitch isn't a know-it-all session. And then the people who are receiving the idea, they're terrible at giving feedback. And it's that ability to focus on the idea, not the person. And when you pitch an idea or when it's been presented to you, there's two aspects to the feedback that make it significantly more precise. One is what I like. What did you like about the idea? And for people who are coming to their bosses maybe the first times, and it's taken a lot of courage for them to step forward with an idea, and the idea might not be helpful on target, it might just be crap all the way around, it is so crucial for you to acknowledge the courage it took for that person to step forward. Mm-hmm. That right there, what I like, helps build their courage and their desire to want to try again. And if you don't acknowledge it, then that's when you start to foster an environment of, if you didn't get it right the first time, then don't even try. I call it the gladiator effect. The idea either lives or dies. And then
you mean you don't want people to thumb up or thumb down, just walk in, show the idea,
and that's it.
And then suddenly the lions come out of the pits, right? Or something like that.
And I'm sure it feels like that to a lot of people. Even if it's a little idea, it feels like a life and death situation. And then the other aspect of feedback is saying what I wish. And the beauty about talking about what I wish is that it focuses again on the idea, not the person. Here's what I wish the idea had that's not there now. And that gives the person coming forward with the idea something concrete that they can go back and work on. And that's, that starts to get rid of that guessing game about, well, I'll know it when I see it. It also puts a lot of onus on the person hearing the idea to make sure that they understand the specific problem that's trying to be solved here, instead of just waiting for random ideas to come out and, let's see where we can pin them to the donkey kind of thing. But, let's really look at what's the problem we have to solve here. Is it a little one? Is it a big one? I mean, I talked to a head of product and marketing who said one of their most innovative ideas the whole year was a woman who looked at how she could automate a process in accounting. It saved 40 manual hours. And you add up 40 hours by 12 months. And he said it was, a couple hundred thousand dollars in man hours, person hours that could be dedicated to something that was more valuable to the organization. Now, is that something particularly creative as a lot of people stereotypically define it? No, particularly innovative. You know, it's not disruptive innovation. It's not going to change your whole market.
It might have been inwardly innovative for that particular company.
And that's just it. And it was, this woman was so proud of how she was able to change, you know, the direction of how her department did something. And she looked at how could I rethink how this is done? And that's a lot of what innovation is rethinking how things are done. And she taught herself how to program. She taught herself a lot of things. And when you can instill that culture, the bigger culture of contributing to ideas, all of a sudden you open this box of opportunity of how people think and how they solve their problems. And that's when it's the culmination of all these micro innovations that add up to a hugely innovative company. And that's when you start to see the revenue performance change.
I want to acknowledge a couple of things you mentioned there, because there's a little bit of nuance. You talked about some people don't know how to give feedback or solicit feedback. And so I wanted to make sure that folks hear that what you recommended was sort of both. What you recommended was good leaders, good feedback givers, okay, are going, if they take that framework in mind, that's going to instill that it's that creative culture we talked about. Even if the creative culture doesn't exist and isn't pervasive just yet across your company, just in that engagement, that interaction with those folks that have been pitching to you, and you know you're receiving there the idea, that's going to get you better stuff down the road. Okay. Then on the flip side, what you're saying is you might not have that great leader that is there yet. And so as the people who are bringing that idea, setting up a framework for getting that feedback by asking those questions is equally important, because it happens quite often, right, where you just walk into someplace and go, hey, I just want to show this to you. And then people who are seeing these creative endeavors, regardless of what that is, design or a campaign or whatever it is, it becomes sort of a free-for-all where maybe that feedback is very unfocused, it's emotional, it's not going to be given in a timely manner. So you've got an hour to talk and you end up talking for 45 minutes about, I don't know if you've ever heard of the term, the hairy wrist. Some of my design friends have said that what they would do is give three different ideas, and what they would do, and they used to have to take photos of the stuff. So one of them, they would accidentally slip in a little bit of the hairy wrist in the photo holding the design as a way of turning the people off of the design they didn't want people to choose.
That's great.
But in any case, I just want to acknowledge that this goes both ways, right? There's a very simple couple things for folks that want to receive constructive feedback that they can put out there. And then also from the other side, in regards to being able to set up a great relationship with that creative individual who may not get it right the first time or the second time, but ultimately you can get there, because creativity is a process. So you don't want to kill that or stifle that from the get-go.
And that's really true. And one thing that people miss when they pitch their idea is they haven't set any context for where it comes from, or, other than, I had this great idea. Okay, well, what were you doing at home on your couch last night that brought this idea to you?
Yeah.
Let's make sure it lives someplace in the real world to solve a problem. So, let's bring everybody together so we're in the same story to start with. I might be in Little Red Riding Hood. You might be in Hansel and Gretel, and somebody else, the other people in the room may be in 3, 4, 5 different stories.
Yeah.
So let's start out and, bring everybody together, remind people of here's the challenge that we face. So then you give context, and then you start to frame the inspiration that you had for the idea. And then because your audience has context in their mind for what's going on, they're not going to start out by saying, this is stupid, this is ridiculous, I don't get it, whether that's conscious or subconscious in their head. Because there's a fair amount of people, particularly when they're trying to pitch to executives, who miss that context, and they just start with numbers and data and they miss the whole opportunity to create a world that you can bring somebody into and then, you know, use the data and the stats and whatever else to prove your point at the end. Because you're never going to convince somebody purely with numbers. You know, if that was true, we would all wear sunscreen, never eat fried foods, you know, get 8 to 9 hours of sleep. You know, it's the data isn't going to do it. You have to give context and then tell the idea journey of your innovative idea with a story and then support it with the evidence. But people forget about these bigger aspects of how you pitch these innovative or creative ideas.
So one of the things that you've talked about related to this theme is the power of observation. Mm-hmm. And I love how you say that observing heightens our awareness and makes us newly sensitive to mundane things. And I have an infinitely curious four-year-old, and driven by that curiosity, he definitely has a heightened sense of awareness of everything around him and asks questions or forces me to look at things differently myself that I may have seen over and over and over again in my lifetime, but they're new to him. How does someone develop the power of observing who's not a four-year-old and who's working in a business in some department?
Yeah, I mean, the main thing is practice. When we're talking about some of these creativity scores from the McKinsey report, you know, back to that ability to hardwire creativity and innovation into daily practices, innovation is, or observation is always the first thing that I suggest people start to practice. And I'm not talking about spend 4 hours every Friday morning and start observing the world around you. I'm talking about 10 or 15 minutes. You know, when you have to stand in line at the grocery store, or, you know, our ability to get out and about now is severely limited. But, you know, what if you sit on your couch and you wrote down all the things you observed for 15 minutes? Mm. And it's not just what do you see, but what do you smell? Like, I can smell the neighbor's flowers from our back windows. You know, I can smell my husband's coffee in his cup in his office. You know, what do you hear? You know, I can hear my teenagers upstairs laughing. I can hear the birds in the trees outside. I can hear our dog do a big sigh. You know, what do you feel? Are you sitting on a hard chair, a soft sofa? You know, and really look at all the number of things you can list. And I absolutely guarantee you this, even if you did this for 15 minutes a day for 5 days, your power of observation would explode. And the reason that as adults it's so stunted is because we are so focused on productivity and getting stuff done. You know, we always take the same route to work. It's efficient. You know, we get up, we have the same routine. We do all of these things on autopilot that I guarantee you. I know when I used to drive to an office, you know, I would get up, go through my morning routine, get in the car, drive to work, and be sitting at my desk for an hour before I went, wait, did I eat breakfast? You know, we're so out of touch, out of tune. And particularly when you add in our, you know, all of the mobile devices that we carry with us all the time, they train us to tune out the world around us.
But well, and part of what you're talking about, there's an element of that that's very much related to mindfulness in one aspect of it. And I think the other part, because it's interesting how people would go, well, if I do it 15 minutes every single day and I don't really have a problem to solve right now, how does that make me more creative? And I think some people might say that. And I think what it boils down to is there's a part of it which is getting you to be more aware. That's one part of it. And then the other is I found that you have an index of things. You have an index of experiences and information and stimulus and all that sort of stuff. And a lot of folks find that they become more quote unquote creative suddenly after going on a vacation someplace overseas or something like that, where everything they see is new. But that's because what they see at home, they haven't tuned in their awareness of the things that are around them because of that autopilot that you're talking about. And so if they're able to tap into that, their awareness of those things that they could index on a daily basis, that would become a sense of inspiration based on like what you were just saying, I think that people would be quite surprised about how much inspiration and how many ideas can come from simply going from being a autopilot piece of concrete to a sponge that's open to the world a little bit differently, even if it's just for a portion of the day.
That's absolutely right, because the more time you spend observing, your mind kicks into these habits, genetic habits. It becomes more curious. And your mind is wired to find patterns and connections. So when I tell people, observe and just start like literally writing down on a piece of paper, I have notebooks all over my house, so I can always grab one and I go out and I will just sit and I'll write down everything I can see and, you know, and feel and taste and touch and whatever it is, the five senses. But what happens is that I talk about all of these observations are these individual dots. And because your mind is a pattern recognition machine, just genetically, it runs all sorts of its programs to start connecting these random dots and start looking for patterns or, you know, constellations. So you can think of your observations as stars and your mind starts making constellations out of them. And so you're sitting in a meeting and you think of a bear. Well, that doesn't have anything to do with what I'm talking about now, but maybe it made an airplane and all of a sudden that made sense. And so just by retraining your mind to be more observant, it kicks in this process, this simple five-step process that is innate to us in coming up with ideas. And I know I remember when my kids were four, like your kids are now, it would, honest to goodness, take us an hour and a half to walk a block down the street, you know, because you got to look at the ants and then you got to look, how can an ant hold that one piece of dirt above their head? And, you know, there's no end to their curiosity. Now, there's got to be a balance, right? Because we don't want a whole corporation acting with the attention span of a bunch of four-year-olds.
What time is that meeting, squirrel? Wait.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, did you see the ants on the sidewalk? Yeah. You know, let's see how big of a boulder you can carry above your head. You
know, stuff. That's like that. Hilarious.
But it's the ability to balance that curiosity and awareness of the world around us and still channel it into productivity. And we can do that. But we tend to get, it's an output of the industrialization of society, is that we're focused on output and efficiency and numbers to the hindrance of our creativity, not just creativity, but critical thinking that comes from observing the world around us. And it hurts us deeply. And you see it during times of chaos and distress, like what we're in now. The most innovative companies in the world understand that this is the greatest time of opportunity, because they have equipped their entire employee base to be hardwired for creative thinking and critical problem solving and innovative, you know, ways that they approach the work that they do in everything they do all day long. And now they're just like, you know, go forth and solve problems. And that's exactly what you need right now.
Yeah. And part of that is adaptation, right? The ability to adapt to what's going on, to adapt to change. So you touched on this a little bit, and I want to dig into this a little bit more. Marketing is usually considered a creative resource within a company. It's when people think of who are the creative folks in the company, they're thinking of somebody in marketing, usually that guy or those folks or whatever it is. But great sort of marketing departments, and even great just marketing in general, the ideas from there can often be stifled by less creative collaborators within other departments. Right? We talked a lot about culture and to look at the marketing department as being the source, the beacon of creativity, and then think that somehow the organization will end up being innovative or creative. That's just not realistic. So do you think that marketing as an opportunity to be the transformative catalyst within the company for creativity and innovation, or does that sit squarely on the shoulders of the C-suite to make that happen?
I think that this, with all of the changes that we've talked about in marketing the last really 20 years, you know, since we were able to go to one-to-one marketing and all of, you know, social media and technology and, you know, marketing was going to have a bigger tech budget than IT by 2017 and taking on, you know, marketing to new HR, and then it now owns customer experience and all of these things. I feel that those have all been the building blocks, the bubbling up point that shows that marketing truly is the has the potential to be the innovation hub of an entire organization. And this is why. One is the chance to change how people see the practice of marketing from being, I call them the do me department. Can you do me a landing page? Can you do me an event? Can you do me a brochure? Can you do me a campaign? You know, those kind of things. And a lot of marketers are really comfortable in that do me role, but it is passive. And to be able to lead innovation, the one critical thing that truly positions marketers to lead it is that they're the ones who can bring the voice of the customer into the organization. Mm-hmm. And if we're really going to be able to solve the problems our customers have and be able to serve them to our full potential as a brand, you need to have marketing in that process all the way through. And when I look at brands that are the best at this, it's marketing who is right in there with their, you know, they've got the main seat at the table in the conversation. Their sleeves are rolled up. They are doing the same kind of work right along with all of these other departments. And I think marketing traditionally has accepted the assumption that we do this little part over here. And, oh, when you're ready, let me know and I'll be there. You know, I'll help out. You know,
like we're, you said reactive.
Exactly. And asking for permission instead of saying, no, uh-uh. You shouldn't even be launching that product because it doesn't even solve anything that matters to our customers. Because there's a lot with innovation that isn't necessarily the product and service that you sell, but it's the way you do business. And I've seen this in big companies. I've seen this in small companies. I mean, one of the companies I talk about a lot is Emerson. It's a digital industrial manufacturing company based in St. Louis, Missouri. And their CMO has done a phenomenal job of using research about customers and bringing that into the product group. And they have an eight stages that they go through to launch a product. And before, they didn't bring marketing in until maybe fourth or fifth step. It's essentially to say, go validate this and find out our messaging. But with their CMO, Kathy Button Bell, what she did is she used customer research to say, okay, no, instead of step 4, 5, or 6, let's go back to stage zero. They call it stage gate zero. And let's figure out if this is even the problem we should be working on. And so before you know, innovation isn't about just putting out the next iteration of the product. It's really looking at the holistic experience that you deliver as an organization.
So I'm abusing your time a little bit because this is such a great conversation and I'm almost at the end. So I beg of you to let me proceed for these last couple of questions here because you've given me so much. The way that this popped into my head, I'm just going to sort of share it with you and you can just tell me if it sounds, you know, like it doesn't apply here, but I'm really interested to hear. It feels a lot like how much of this is inspiration versus perspiration. And what I mean by that is in what you share and what I've seen as well, there's an element which is about inspiring individuals to understand and tap into that creative element within themselves so that they can, like we talked about, giving the right type of feedback, creating the right type of company culture, all that sort of stuff. And then there's an actual like mechanics and process to doing the work and going through the process. And even in the end, you know, pitching that idea and delivering that idea by executing on it. What are your thoughts on like how much of this is about inspiring people to be open to new ideas within the company and the fact that they can be massively creative versus applying the process, the time, the resources to doing the work with those ideas rather than simply shoveling those off to the creative department and then having them do those things?
Yeah, there's a couple of things in there. And you mentioned the inspiration, perspiration balance, and they say it's what, 10% inspiration, 90% perspiration, that really you just have to, you know, work your patootie off and that's what it takes to become innovative. But that mindset to me ties into The other one that I wanted to mention is that people say coming up with the idea is the easy part. Mm. Executing it is the hard part. But I believe that it takes 90% in perspiration, and that execution is the hard part because you haven't come up with quality ideas to start with.
Mm.
And that's been my quest and why my mission is to change the way we think about innovation, is because we are offloading the idea development to agencies, to the creative department, to the innovation department, because we think it's way more complex than it has to be. We think it's, we think you need a McKinsey or a high ticket consultant to come in and tell us what to do and how to do it. But the truth is, it doesn't have to be that hard, but you have to understand always what's a problem you're trying to solve. Now, you have to be able to go through methodically this five-step process that I've learned from the people I've interviewed, because it connects all the dots. And what you end up with are more ideas that are better ideas. And you know what it's like when you go to choose anything. If you have more to choose from and the whole quality level is better to start with, whatever your end product is going to be exponentially better because you have better to start with. You think about growing a garden. I mean, I live in Colorado. We have a lot of hard clay, crappy ground to work with. But if you go to Nebraska, where I grew up, and it's that dark, black, rich soil, of course I'm going to pick that to start with. Well, the same thing with ideas. If you can pick the richness of idea soil, that's better to start with. You need less perspiration. Mm. You need less effort to execute it because you're starting out ahead of the game.
I love that. Now, I usually say at the end of the podcast, this is the most important question. This is the one question where we all want answered. But this one is a little bit lower down from this, because I want to hear something from you about yourself and your creativity and your sort of place of inspiration and stuff. But I find that that people have sort of established, people that have an established regular creative process, whether that's their main job or whether it's just part of sort of who they are and they've put in place a creative process for themselves, they have a place that they like to go and sit with problems longer or deeper or projects that they're working on in order to really sort of accelerate what they're doing, even if it's for a short while. So it's like the place where the creative side flourishes. So I don't know if you know that our friend Brian Kramer, he loves to be by the water. He loves to be close to the beach, right? And for me, as I was thinking about it, I'm not sure necessarily if it's a physical place, but I do find that I enjoy spending time on YouTube, funny enough, because you see lots of folks there that are consistently exploring creativity, capturing it and sharing it with people, and sort of creating this index. It helps me create this index of, oh, I didn't even know that was possible. Or they just showed me 15 ways that they paint, using food or shoes or whatever it is that they're doing. And it makes you think, right? How can you ad lib and do these things differently yourself? So I follow a lot of people that are constantly exploring their creativity and stuff on YouTube. For you, is there a special place? Is there a place where when you really want to go and think deep about something or work on something with your business or for a client or something, that it just accelerates things and that's your special creative getaway?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, it is being outside. I was the biggest tomboy growing up, and I just lived outside, and especially in the summer, I have to be away from cement. We live in Colorado for a reason. All the the hiking and the biking and the ability to get outside. And if I can add on top of that, more travel, that definitely is it, because you touched on it earlier about when you go someplace else that's very different for you, everything is just so obvious and you can't take anything for granted. And when my husband and I were just talking the other day about, we were in this little mountain town in Switzerland a couple of years ago. And I distinctly remember sitting on the little deck of this sandwich shop where we were, and I'm sure we were drinking a beer, but we look out and it's just like mountains up and high for as far as you can see. And I think there is something for nearly every human that being outside, you know, hearing nature. I'm a water person too. It relaxes our mind. And that's a big part of allowing space for ideas to flow. And recognizing that is a huge part of anybody's creative journey. I mean, I tend to be also very prolific as a writer in airports. You know, if I can get to an airport and have a, you know, couple hours before my flight would leave, I can crank out all sorts of content. And it's just one of those things that for whatever reason, really, really works for me.
I don't know about you, but the thing, because I also, when thinking about this, and I felt like it was a real kind of weird cop out there with the YouTube thing for me, but you reminded me of something else. But the airport aspect, there's something about airports that's like punching a hole in whatever, you know, city or location the airport's in, where all of these humans are from so many different cultures and places and everything, that is just, there's something so cool about that. I find that it's not a place that I can go per se in order to get, to sit and focus on something for a client or inspiration, but it definitely like sort of is like going to your local park. You see the folks you normally see, you go to the airport and suddenly you're just like, what's that family? What are they doing? Why are they here? And, you know, people, from all over the place. But the outside thing, you totally reminded me. I started to do way more hiking over the last, I'd say, 3 or so years. And, I find that when I go hiking by myself, that's when, because I'm so used to sitting in front of a computer and you've got the kid, you're doing all these things every single day. And then suddenly you're going by yourself and your only job is to just walk or to climb or whatever it is. And doing that in a nice big open space and doing that for a couple hours, I definitely think that that's a place where suddenly things just pop suddenly into your head and you're, oh, I better, you know, write that down or whatever. That's certainly a place where I think I get some inspiration. I got a bike recently, so I'm hoping that becomes another place too, where you just zoom off
into
a road or a trail.
I love those things like hiking and biking and we ski a lot, because for me, it's the physical movement and motion. It makes me feel like a kid. And it just, whenever you do things like that, you're the chemical response in your brain is very different. And I think when you're reminded physically that you feel like a kid, you kind of start to think like a kid too.
Yeah, I think part of it, again, has to do with the presence. You're present at that point, where in a lot of other times we're running a little bit on autopilot, right? You've got to be present when you're zooming down a slope or on a bike or something like that. Well, I want to close out by saying, A, thank you. Thank you so much for allowing me to extend your time out a little bit. It's a secret between me and the listeners is I didn't even tell her how long the podcast was. But we ended up going longer than I would normally do because there was so much awesome stuff. And then secondly is, where can people find out about what's your most recent project? You've written so many great books. You're doing a lot of, you have been doing, I'm not sure now due to COVID stuff at the moment, but I'm sure when things die down, you're doing lots of great speaking and stuff all over the place. But what do you have on deck right now that people should be paying attention to?
You know, what I'm like ready to hit submit on is the final manuscript on my 10th book.
Oh, wow.
10th book called Rethink Innovation. And it's how the world's most prolific innovators consistently come up with great ideas that turn into these extraordinary outcomes. And it'll be in bookstores probably late spring next year, but available, you know, more independently, probably on Amazon and through my website between probably October and then whenever it's out in bookstores. But I'd love to invite people to visit my website at carlajohnson.co. There's no M, just C-O, and Carla with a C. And when you go there, there's an opportunity to sign up for my newsletter, which comes out every week. And if you're a subscriber, you get lots of free things and insights that don't show up other places on my blog or social media or anything like that. So that's the best kind of place you get early notice for things that are coming out. And I like to give away the free stuff, free research and things like that that I work on, because I know being a subscriber means you've committed your time and you put your trust in me. And I like to share what I know with the people who care about the same kind of things that I care about, particularly, you know, innovation and thinking differently about the work that we do as marketers.
Well, just like you said, this sort of thing is needed more now than it ever has before. I hope that the listeners enjoyed it as much as I did. And I want to dig into some other stuff with you sometime in the future. So I hope you'll be back.
I'd love to. Thank you so much for having me today. I really enjoyed it, Adam.
Thanks again. I love that you finished the episode. I super appreciate that you spent your time with us. You could have been in so many other places. Maybe you were avoiding those other places and that's why you spent time with us. At any rate, I hope the time was well spent. And if you could do one thing for us, it would be incredible if you could subscribe to the podcast. And if you've already done that, first, I'd love to give you a hug when I see you next. And second, if you would then instead rate and review the podcast, it helps us get discovered. It helps others that are interested in the topics find us. And all the way around, it is super appreciated. If you'd like to connect with us for any reason, you'd like to connect with me directly and ask me some questions about marketing, or maybe suggest a topic for an episode that we should be talking about, go ahead and email me at adam@secretsushi.com. Or just generally check us out at secretsushi.com to see what we're up to. All right, take care.